This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
Just because they seem normal doesn't mean they are. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Picture this. You're facing trial for allegedly orchestrating a murder-for-hire plot, and the one thing keeping you connected to your defense team gets ripped away because of bureaucratic red tape. That's exactly what happened to Donna Adelson this week when she got shuffled from one detention facility to another, not because she caused trouble, but because Leon County decided inmates in protective custody couldn't have tablets anymore. It's like being told you can't use your phone during the most important business negotiation of your life, except in this case. The business is convincing 12 people you didn't help plan a murder. The timing couldn't be more ironic. Donna Adelson, the 73-year-old mother who prosecutors say was the financial mastermind behind a family conspiracy to murder Florida State University law professor Dan Markell, just got moved to Wakulla Detention Facility on June 6th. Here's a woman who allegedly helped orchestrate one of the most calculated murders in recent Florida history, now getting sympathy because she can't properly communicate with her lawyers due to administrative incompetence. Here's what went down. Leon County Sheriff's Office implemented a new policy that basically said, if you're in administrative or protective confinement, you can't have a tablet. Now, tablets aren't just for entertainment in jail. They're how inmates communicate with their attorneys in the digital age. Donna's defense attorney, Josh Zellman, painted a sob story about how his client would get exactly 20 minutes out of her cell on Tuesdays and Thursdays, 1 hour on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and absolutely nothing on weekends. That's like trying to prepare for the bar exam while locked in a closet, except most people taking the bar exam didn't allegedly finance a murder plot first. The irony here is remarkable. We're supposed to feel bad that a woman accused of paying hitmen to kill her daughter's ex-husband is having trouble accessing her legal team. It's like complaining that the getaway car has a flat tire. The transfer to Wakulla wasn't some strategic legal move. It was damage control to make sure Donna gets the constitutional protections she allegedly denied Dan Markell when he was gunned down in his driveway. Let's talk about why this case has captivated everyone who follows true crime. The Dan Markell murder started as what looked like a random shooting and slowly revealed itself to be one of the most twisted family conspiracies in modern criminal history. Markell, a respected law professor, was assassinated in July 2014, and the subsequent investigation uncovered an alleged murder-for-hire plot that reads like a masterclass in how privilege and entitlement can lead to devastating criminal decisions. The prosecution's theory is straightforward and compelling. Markell was locked in a bitter custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson, Donna's daughter. When Wendy wanted to move to South Florida with their kids and Markell refused, the family allegedly decided the problem could be solved with a bullet rather than through the legal system like normal people. It's the ultimate example of thinking money and family connections can solve any problem, even murder. The cast of characters reads like a criminal enterprise run by people who watch too many mob movies. There's Charlie Adelson, Donna's son and a dentist who allegedly coordinated the hit, currently serving life in prison in South Dakota. There's Catherine, Charlie's alleged accomplice and former girlfriend, also convicted. And then there are the actual shooters, Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera, who allegedly pulled the trigger for what amounts to pocket change compared to the Adelson family wealth. Rivera took a plea deal and testified against the others, while Garcia got life without parole. It's like watching people with medical degrees and professional licenses decide that hiring hitmen is easier than dealing with family court. And now we get to Donna, who prosecutors say was the alleged bankroller of this whole operation. At 73, she doesn't look like a criminal mastermind, but that's exactly what makes this case so disturbing. This isn't some hardened criminal from the streets. This is allegedly a grandmother who decided murder was preferable to losing access to her grandchildren. The evidence against her includes wiretapped conversations where she allegedly discusses the plot, financial records showing suspicious transactions, and testimony from family members who decided saving their own skin was more important than family loyalty. The delays in her trial tell you everything about how overwhelming the evidence must be. Originally scheduled for June 3rd, jury selection got pushed to August 19th because her defense team claims they need more time to wade through over 80,000 emails and numerous wiretap recordings. When you need months just to review the evidence of your alleged crimes, that's not exactly a good sign for your innocence. It's like needing a forklift to carry all the receipts of your supposed wrongdoing. Donna's legal team is fighting battles on multiple fronts, which tells you how desperate their situation has become. They filed a petition trying to get Judge Stephen Everett removed from the case, claiming improper communications. They're also pushing for a change of venue, arguing that Leon County has been so saturated with coverage that finding an unbiased jury is impossible. The change of venue hearing on June 13th could determine whether this trial stays in Tallahassee or moves somewhere the Adelson name hasn't become synonymous with murder for hire. The pretrial publicity argument is actually reasonable, though it's rich coming from a family that allegedly thought they were above the law in the first place. When your family name becomes associated with one of the most notorious murders in a city's history, finding 12 people who haven't formed an opinion is genuinely challenging. The defense spent 2.5 hours arguing that potential jurors have been contaminated by years of media coverage, which is probably true, but that's what happens when you allegedly commit crimes that shock an entire community. The plot keeps thickening because this family apparently never learned when to stop digging. Recently, a jailhouse informant allegedly came forward claiming that Donna offered to pay for witness testimony in her upcoming trial. This led prosecutors to get wiretap warrants for her husband Harvey's phone because evidently the family's alleged criminal behavior didn't end with murder. It's like watching someone set their house on fire and then pouring gasoline on it to put out the flames. The fact that prosecutors felt the need to wiretap Harvey's communications shows they believe this family is still actively trying to obstruct justice. Jailhouse informants aren't always reliable, but when you're already facing murder charges and new allegations of witness tampering emerge, even skeptical prosecutors start paying attention. It suggests that either Donna learned nothing from watching her son get convicted, or she's so desperate that she's willing to risk additional charges. The protective custody situation adds a darkly comic element to this tragedy. Donna isn't in protective custody because she's dangerous to others. She's there because other inmates have allegedly tried to assault and extort her. There's something almost poetic about a woman accused of orchestrating a murder needing protection from actual criminals. It's like being the least popular person at a convention for people you thought you belonged with. What makes this case legally fascinating is how it demonstrates the prosecution of family-based conspiracies. Unlike typical criminal enterprises where relationships are transactional, family conspiracies operate on emotional bonds and shared interests that can make them both more durable and more destructive. When wealthy, educated family members allegedly decide that murder is easier than losing a custody battle, it reveals a level of entitlement and moral bankruptcy that's genuinely disturbing. The prosecution has been methodical and devastating in building their case. They started with the shooters and worked their way up the alleged conspiracy ladder, securing convictions at each level. By the time they got to Donna, they had multiple convicted co-conspirators willing to testify, years of wiretapped conversations, and financial records that allegedly show her role in financing the plot. It's like building a pyramid of evidence where each conviction makes the next one easier to obtain. From a defense perspective, Donna's lawyers face an almost impossible task. They're trying to separate their client from a family conspiracy that's already resulted in multiple convictions, including her own son. It's like trying to claim you weren't part of a bank robbery when your relatives are already in prison for the same crime, and the security footage shows you handing out ski masks. The defense essentially has to argue either that Donna was completely innocent, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, or that she was somehow manipulated by other family members into participating in murder. The prosecution's job is to prove that Donna wasn't just aware of her family's alleged activities, but actively participated in planning and financing them. given the evidence that's already been presented in other trials, including wiretapped conversations and financial records, this seems like a relatively straightforward task. The difference between being related to criminals and being a criminal yourself might seem significant, but when the evidence allegedly shows you bankrolling the operation, that distinction becomes meaningless. This case challenges comfortable assumptions about who commits serious crimes. We expect murder conspiracies to involve hardened criminals operating in dark alleys, not affluent families solving domestic disputes with assassination plots. The alleged involvement of a dentist, his mother, and their extended family in a murder-for-hire scheme is disturbing precisely because it shows how privilege and entitlement can lead to monstrous decisions. The case demonstrates how family loyalty can become criminal conspiracy, how custody disputes can escalate into violence, and how people with resources can allegedly choose murder over accepting legal defeat. It also raises uncomfortable questions about how wealth and social status can insulate people from consequences until the evidence becomes overwhelming. For Donna Adelson, August 19th represents the moment when years of alleged criminal behavior finally catch up with her. The prosecution has built what appears to be an overwhelming case based on wiretapped conversations, financial records, and testimony from multiple convicted co-conspirators. The defense is left arguing technicalities and hoping for jury nullification from people who might feel sympathy for an elderly defendant. The jury will decide whether they believe the prosecution's evidence that Donna was a key figure in a family murder conspiracy, or the defense's increasingly desperate arguments that she was somehow innocent, despite all evidence to the contrary. Given the convictions of her co-conspirators and the mountain of evidence that's been assembled, the prosecution's confidence seems well-founded. This trial represents the final chapter in the systematic prosecution of an alleged family criminal enterprise that shocked Florida. Whether Donna gets convicted or somehow manages to escape justice, the Dan Markell murder will remain a cautionary tale about how privilege, entitlement, and family dysfunction can combine to create genuine evil. The prison transfer might seem like a minor detail, but it's just another example of how even accused murderers get constitutional protections that they allegedly denied their victims.
He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.